is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, July 23rd, 2019. I'm Buster Olney, and this is a baggage claim Tuesday. I am at Gate 8A on the D Concourse in Atlanta. Troy, how you doing back there in Bristol?
Doing great. It's a wet one back here, Buster. Hopefully the weather is a little better where you are.
Yeah, I'm flying back into the New York area, so I'm hoping that I can avoid some of the thunderstorms they're talking about, or else I'm going to be on the D Concourse for a lot of hours of today, Troy. All right, let's get to the news and notes of the day. The Chicago White Sox have become the first team in Major League Baseball to extend protective netting from foul pole to foul pole. That started with Monday's game against the Marlins. Francisco Lindor, the Indian shortstop, who was at the plate when he hit a foul ball the other day and hit a fan who had to be hospitalized, he was asked about the netting.
Sucks. I encourage every MLB team to put the nets all the way down. I know defense is all about defense, the experience of interacting with players, and I completely get that. You know, you want to have that interaction with the fans, getting autographs and stuff. But at the end of the day, we want to make sure everybody comes out of this game healthy, and we got to do something about it. It sucks. Everybody feels bad. And if we can put all the nets a little bit further down, I think it would be a lot better.
White Sox manager Rick Renteria talked about the extended netting.
Obviously, it's a great stat. I think they've done a nice job, as I just looked at it before I came to speak to you all, so I could speak truthfully about it. Looks like there's no inhibiting factors in terms of watching, being able to see things, but it should obviously keep, you know, high-velocity screamers and some bats from going into the stands, you know, causing injury.
White Sox outfielder Eloy Jimenez had some thoughts.
We don't want to hurt nobody in the field with line drive or high fly ball. The people can catch it, you know. I feel really good for that. The fans going to be safe now.
Well, the White Sox had a good night against the Marlins with help from Yoan Moncada.
The 1-0, high and deep to center field. Give me chase. Cuello to the wall, to the fence. It is gone. A three-run home run for Moncada to straightaway center field.
What were you saying about he likes to drive in runs? He got three with a swing.
It's one of those things you just feel before it happens.
Darren Jackson, Ed Farmer on WGN, the White Sox, with a 9-1 win. Ivan Nova had a complete game in that contest. The Twins faced the Yankees, and early on, top of the first inning, Twins did something special.
And the 2-2 pitch. Ground ball to third. Might be three. Adais steps. Second one. The return. Triple play! The Twins get three. And Martin escapes. A triple play off the bat of Encarnacion. Adais, the glove, stepped on the bag. To second for two. Scopes return. Caught by Sano. And that's three.
Coy Provis on the Treasure Island Baseball Network with that excellent call. And in this game, the Twins hit a bunch of home runs.
And he'll two on the way.
Hit high in the air, left field. That ball is going to be out of here. On an 0-2 hanger, Garver, a two-homer game.
Yeah, that's right. Mitch Garver with his second homer of the game. The Twins had five in this game. They beat the Yankees 8-6. The Astros took care of business against Oakland, winning 11-1 with help from Yordan Alvarez.
Outfield is deep. Center fielder Laureano shaded slightly the other way. 0-1. And that's hit well and deep to right center. Canna is going back at the wall, looking up. See you later! Over the Astros bullpen. Yordan Alvarez goes deep for the 11th time this year.
Well, you can't throw that get-me-over slider to Alvarez. He's all over it.
Call from Robert Ford and Steve Sparks. Sparksy, KBME 790 AM. Garrett Cole rolled in this game. Struck out Matt Olson on a 98-mile-per-hour fastball in the fourth inning. That, according to Brian McTaggart of MLB.com. And he reached 200 strikeouts with that strikeout. That is in 133 and a third innings. The second fewest behind Randy Johnson, who threw 130.2 innings, two-thirds innings, in 2001. To get to his 200 strikeouts, and Garrett Cole talked about that accomplishment after the game.
It's a nice accomplishment. I mean, anytime you're mentioned with the unit, it's pretty special. He kind of goes down in folklore as one of the best pitchers of all time. So really cool statistic. Might have a glass of wine about it tonight. You know, outside of that, you know, we got at least 13 more starts to go, so...
Tough news for the Brewers before their game against the Reds. Brandon Woodruff had to come out, the all-star right-hander, out of their game on Sunday because of a left oblique strain. Well, manager Craig Counsell told reporters on Monday that he's expected to miss 6 weeks, and perhaps this is going to spur the Brewers in the market for starting pitching. And then as the game played out, the Brewers had a lead and then lost.
That's a drive. Hammered to deep left, and Suarez has done it again. Booming two-run home run that made the seats in left field. With two out here in the ninth inning, and with Senzel scoring ahead of him, the Reds have regained the lead at 6-5. How about that?
How about that? The Hall of Famer Marty Brenneman with that call in 700 WLW. Before Boston's game against the Rays, Alex Cora, the Red Sox manager, was pretty direct in talking about how these last games before the trade deadline could be meaningful in the decisions that Boston makes about whether or not to be buyers or sellers before the deadline. And with those words resonating, we'll talk about that coming up with Bob Nightingale of USA Today. With those words resonating, the Red Sox took care of business against the Rays.
3-2 on the way from Beek. Swing, high fly ball, cranked into center field. At the track, at the wall, it's gonna jump on out of here! Three-run home run, J.D. Martinez, there's the offense, Boston 5, and Tampa Bay nothing.
Josh Lewin, WEI, 93.7 FM. The Rangers have absolutely collapsed since the All-Star break, and they played the Mariners last night. Here's what happened.
Here's 1-0 to Kyle. Pitch swung on, driven to deep right center field. Headed for the Root Sports side. Got a lot of carry up against the wall. It's gone! A home run for Kyle Seager. Kyle with his 7th home run, 19th run batted in for Kyle Seager.
Rick Riz, 710 ESPN Seattle. And Seattle with a 7-3 win now. Texas, 8 straight losses. Troy Farkas, the only Ranger fan that I know personally. I think this makes it very easy in their decision to buy or sell. Yesterday I was talking with general managers saying, hey, if you have a Mike Minor and you have the Astros in your division who are a powerhouse this year, will be next year, the Angels are getting better, you absolutely sell. What do you think?
I think I'm going to join Garrett Cole with that glass of wine, although we'll be drinking for different reasons.
Well, yeah, get somebody call Blowfish. We need a special shipment in for Troy as this losing streak continues for the Texas Rangers. The Cardinals against the Pirates, and these two teams played into extra innings. It was 2-2, top of the 10th inning. St. Louis loaded the bases, and this happened.
And here it comes to Goldie, and there's a swing and a fly ball to right field, and it's deep. Backing up is the right fielder to the track, to the wall, and it's gone! Grand slam, home run, Goldschmidt in the 10th, and the Cardinals take a big lead behind Paul Goldschmidt.
That from the Cardinals Radio Network. Yeah, big lead, 6-2. But you know what? The Pirates picked away at it.
Wow.
Another base runner. Another base runner. Tying run to the plate.
This
now.
Team is ridiculous. Jung Ho Gung with home run number 10. And it's a one-run game.
That's right. They cut the lead to 6-5. That's from the Pirates television network. And the rally for the Pirates continued with two outs. And this is what happened.
Two Stallings. Swing and a base hit to right field. Charging it is Martinez. He comes up and throws home. And a play at the plate. And he is out at the plate. He's out at the plate. Martinez throws him out. Right on the money.
That's exactly right. Jose Martinez, who's defensively challenged, comes up with a big play in the bottom of the 10th inning, and the Cardinals win the game 6-5. That from the Cardinals Radio Network.
Deep center field. The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
The game of the day in San Francisco. So much focus on the Giants and their decisions leading up to the trade deadline and their recent winning streak. They face the Chicago Cubs in the top of the 2nd inning. A rookie Cub did something pretty special.
Garcia drives one in the air, deep right field. That ball might be a splashdown. All the way gone. Home run, Robel Garcia to right. I think it landed in the San Francisco Bay on the fly. Cubs lead 1-0.
That was Pat Hughes on the Cubs radio network. 454 feet, that ball landing in McCovey Cove. And the Cubs will go on to take a 4-2 lead into the bottom of the eighth inning. Joe Maddon called on Pedro Strop to hold down the Giants in the bottom of the eighth, and it started to fritter away. Austin Slater came through.
Driven into right center field. El Moro on the move. He can't get it. This game is tied.
Dwayne Kuiper on NBC Sports Bay Area. The other day I was texting back and forth between Kuiper and I, you know, we were talking about how well the Giants are playing, and he joked that they own innings 10 through 16 of late. Well, they owned the eighth inning in this game with a score tied 4-4. Joe Panik came to the plate.
So now Joe Panik with a chance to put the Giants ahead. And he swings and he slashes one fair. Past third, down the left field line, into the corner. Racing around third to score the go-ahead run is Slater on a Joe Panik double. And this place is just going nuts right now.
And why not? Because the Giants just keep on winning. John Miller on KNBR. Giants win 5-4 over Chicago. They are now over 500 for the first time this year. Manager Bruce Bochy talked about the day.
I mean, the way they're fighting, battling back, I mean, what a comeback tonight. And, you know, we had some hits. We just were missing that big hit in the eighth inning. Had some guys really just showed some great at-bats there. Slater, man, that's huge. But Joe Panik, I mean, it just got contagious there. And just a really good comeback. And you look at, you know, the pen, too. Once again, I know God gave up a run, but Palm goes out there for the first time, and what a great job he did bridging the gap there to get to our guys. And so really, really great game for us.
And the Giants continue their surge. As we get closer to the trade deadline, everyone wondering what they're going to do, maybe some questions about the Red Sox and with other teams. And guess what? There'll be more robo-umping for the rest of this season. Let's get to it. Bob Nightingale covers baseball for USA Today. He's on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line up very early out in San Francisco. We're taping this at about 8:15 Eastern time. Bob, getting up at 5:15, that's insane. Are you just coming in?
Well, it's a lot of time last night with Bruce Bochy, so when the game's been as nice. But, yeah, fun to see what the Giants are doing, and great for Bruce Bochy.
Yeah, and I tell you what, I mean, they are, at the top of the list when you talk about what needs to be decided before the July 31st trade deadline, because they have the most in terms of volume of marketable guys if they decide to become sellers. You got Madison Bumgarner, you got about five relievers that they could trade. We talked on Monday, we talked to the NL last week how, you know, given how well they're playing and with that win last night to go over 500 for the first time this year, I think all the expectations that they're going to be sellers day by day, as long as they keep winning, they go to the side. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you talk to the players inside that clubhouse, and they say, hey, it was expressed to them that, hey, if you guys win, you get to stay together. It's almost like they're trying to win so bad, so they're not broken up in parts. Kind of reminds you of the old movie Major League, where they're going against their front office's plans by winning so much. And, yeah, they're having a good time in there. Those young guys that give him a lot of energy. And I think you all want to see Bruce Bochy, you know, go on top. I'm not saying win the World Series, but at least get to October.
Yeah, and Farhan Zaidi is the head of their baseball ops. And, you know, this is the first year he's had working with Boch as manager. So it's not like he has a long history there. He has no history with his team in terms of its, you know, a success in the postseason in the last 10 years. But you have all these players who remember being the second wild card team in 2014 and going all the way and winning the World Series. You have all those fans who do that as well. And I think push comes to shove. If, let's say, in the next week they win, you know, they go 4-2, I think the decision's easy for Farhan. Just ride it out, considering how well they're playing. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, now it's like he can tell teams, hey, I'm not trading, you know, a Baumgartner unless I get overwhelmed here. You know, the fan base will go nuts. You know, same with the Will Smith. You know, there's some talk in in the clubhouse and front office, like, well, you know, do they keep Baumgartner now? And just you can always give a qualifying offer. At least you get draft picks at the end, and maybe trade a Will Smith because you've got so many closers or relievers, I should say. And you're probably not going to give a qualifying offer to Will Smith, you know, and give him $18 million. So they could go, you know, both ways here. It's fascinating. I mean, they do have a rough schedule in August and September. You know, I don't know if they can keep this up, but the fans are loving it. They had 37,000 fans last night. Granted, a lot of them were Cub fans, but, you know, it sort of looked like the good old days in San Francisco.
What does Boch think, Bruce Bochy think, what changed with this team? Because I got to tell you, you know, there were times early in the year when I was watching them play, like, oh, man, they look completely dead. Some of their veteran players look like they had absolutely no life to them. You're wondering if you're watching the end of some really storied careers, and yet here they are. What's changed in your eyes?
Yeah, I was talking to him last night after the game, and he says, you know, this is the most stunning turnaround he's ever been a part of. I mean, granted, he's had – you know, some teams that have, you know, run off 16 or 19 before, but not out of the blue like this. And he thought the same thing as we thought, you know, that the team was dead and buried. But he said when they brought those young guys up from Sacramento, they brought so much energy in that clubhouse, and they started getting, you know, key hits and just this momentum roll. I mean, it's been a unbelievable work. They win all these close games. They've won, they played 93 innings now in the last 8 days with all these extra inning games, and they're winning all these close games.
Boy, and remind you that, what was it, 2012 was the torture team? You know, that was the line,
right,
Dwayne
right.
Kuiper, I think, coined at some point, you know, that every game that they play is torture, and it's been that way. I mentioned at the top of the show, I was texting back and forth with Kuiper, and he goes, yeah, we own innings 10 through 16, because it just feels like that they find a way to work it out. A team trying to find some traction as we get close to the trade deadline, the Boston Red Sox, they win last night, and as of this morning, 10 games out in the American League East, that's pretty much lost to the Yankees at this point. They are currently fourth in the wild card chase, 2 games out. And it was very interesting to me last night, Bob, that Alex Cora, the Red Sox manager, was very direct about the challenge for this team in the week ahead with the deadline. And his quote was, I think everyone is smart around here to understand how it works. We do need to play better. Everyone knows it. We've been talking about this since Oakland. The front office has a job to do. Obviously, our goals are set to win the World Series. If it doesn't look that way and they go somewhere else and take another approach, you got to respect that. And he's talking about the possibility that if in the days ahead the Red Sox veer downward, there's a possibility of them selling. And look, they've got 2 more games in the series against the Rays. They have a day off on Thursday, and then they have a 4-game set against the Yankees. And at that point, the front office probably will assess and see what happens. I never would have imagined, Bob, at the beginning of the season, we'd be talking about even the possibility of a Red Sox sell-off. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I still don't see it, Buster. Even if they have a lousy, you know, next, 8-9 days here, I just can't see a sell-off. You know, I can see standing pat. It's just not Dave Dombrowski's style. I mean, he did it that last year in Detroit. Next thing you knew, he was out as the GM. He's got 1 more year left of that contract. He has not, you know, been given an extension yet either. I just can't see him giving up on, even this year, but let alone 2020. You know, he's one of the few GMs in the game that are aggressive, and I think that's why it's such a slow trade deadline. All these GMs just hang on to their prospects. You know, they get contract extensions. You know, very few guys are like him and Matthew Epstein, you know, where you actually just go for the gusto, trade these prospects, and try to get a World Series.
I was talking with executives with other teams after Alex's comments and made his comments to reporters yesterday, and they were wondering what exactly a Red Sox sell-off would look like. There's a lot of speculation in the Boston media that, you know, heck, it's not out of the realm of possibility that Mookie Betts gets traded before the deadline if the Red Sox turn south. Bob, I think there's no chance of that happening because, as you know, teams talk about how it's so much easier to deal position players during the offseason, big name guys who have a lot of value during the offseason, because you can involve, you know, a lot more teams versus during the season when teams have much more specific needs. And it would seem like it would have to be such a complex, big deal that I just can't see them putting together something for Mookie Betts. Rick Porcello might be a guy who could potentially get moved. You know, there's speculation about David Price. I think with, you know, his elbow injury, I don't think any team takes on his salary. But one guy who is interesting to me, and, you know, we're just talking theoretically, if the Red Sox were to lose, let's say, the next six games in a row, one guy is interesting to me is J.D. Martinez, because he's a Scott Boras client. He has an opt-out on his contract at the end of this year. And if you are the Red Sox and you believe that he's going to opt out, and I do think there's some logic behind him doing that. We saw last winter Andrew McCutchen got 3 years and $50 million at about the same age from the Phillies. We saw Carlos Santana 2 winters ago get 3 years and $60 million at about the same age where JD's at. I think he's going to be able to replicate the contract that he has left with the Red Sox at 3 for $66 million. And maybe if you're Boston and you feel like, you know what, you know, we think JD's going to opt out, why not flip him for a prospect? You can always bid on him as a free agent in the fall. So I think about a team like the Dodgers potentially, you know, with their hitting coach, Robert Van Skoyak, who's JD Martinez's right-hand man in remaking his swing. He would be an interesting name to me if he actually went out there. What do you think?
No, he would be interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure this guy opts out. You know, we've seen the free agent market. I don't know if he's going to do any better than that. It's certainly intriguing. Now, I could see a Porcello for sure, you know, free agent. And, I don't see them, bringing him back in 2020. I really don't. So Porcello makes sense. But J.D. Martinez, I'm not sure about, you know, big part of that team, big part of that clubhouse. I'm with you on, Mookie Betts. There's no way in the world I see them trading Mookie Betts. Now, I think Mookie will test the free agent market in a couple of years. I don't see him signing, you know, a long-term extension unless you're talking, you know, Mike Trout-type money. But I certainly don't see them pushing him or turning him out the door.
So just following up on that, you disagree with me that you think that J.D. could replicate necessarily the money he has left in the Red Sox deal. You don't think that's a slam dunk, I'm guessing, because we've seen with sluggers not getting paid in recent years, especially guys over 30.
Yeah, absolutely. No, he's still having a good season. He's not having the same season as he had in 2018. But yeah, I just think so many of those teams back away, and it gets scary out there. You know, he was talking about at the All-Star game that, hey, free agency, he thought was going to be, you know, great and a fun time. In his words, it was a nightmare. You know, I think at one point he thought he was going to get $200 million, and obviously that didn't happen. In Boston, you know, they stayed firm the whole time, you know, at that 100, 110 mark. And nobody came up to even challenge them. I think the next best bid was the Diamondbacks at about $20 million. So I don't think he wants to go through that again.
Yeah, and the X factor being Scott Boras, his agent, who, as you know, has been absolutely aggressive in trying to max out dollars. That's what happened with Dallas Keuchel. It's what the reason why we waited and waited and waited on Bryce Harper signing, because he wanted to try to push the numbers, and that's why I wonder if JD still will try to do that, hoping that at some point some team will jump in, you know, maybe like the Texas Rangers, who are moving in a new ballpark next year. One interesting name as we get close to the trade deadline, Felipe Vasquez of the Pirates. Neil Huntington, the Pirates GM, told reporters that he downplayed the possibility that his closer will be traded before the deadline. Bob, I've talked with other teams, and they say, man, this guy's value right now in the trade market is so high that, a team like the Dodgers could potentially jump on him. Another contender, maybe the Yankees would be their focus if they could upgrade their bullpen if they didn't find a suitable starting pitcher. Maybe it would be the Atlanta Braves with all that young starting pitching. And they feel like that if they were sitting in Neil's shoes, they would push to make a deal for reliever, because they say if you have a reliever, especially for a small market team that builds value, you need to max out on that. And they pointed out that the Pirates have been really good at identifying closers through the years, and they would trade Vasquez given his current value. What do you think?
Well, I mean, you're right about that. They've been great grabbing relievers and grooming them. You know, I wonder, Buster, if they're going to be gun shy after the Chris Archer trade. You know, just, with Glasnow and Meadows, you know, seeing them become stars in Tampa. it's like, you know, wait a minute now. If you were going to go for it and try to be competitive by trading for Archer, now why are you going the other direction? So I'm not sure what they want to do there. It's almost like they're in no man's land. You know, they're not going for it, obviously, and they're not, you know, selling off either. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me that they're keeping them, just because I don't think they're ready to, you know, be an aggressive team. They want to stay competitive, even though, you know, the Cubs and the Cardinals are starting to run away from the pack here.
Yeah, Neil mentioned to reporters, I'm paraphrasing here, that if they didn't think they were going to contend in 2020 or have a chance to, that maybe they would be more open-minded, but that's their expectations that they'll be in the run next year. Two more quick ones for you before you go. The Atlantic League will announce later today that it will use that automated ball strike system for the rest of the regular season. For me, Bob, not a surprise. I mean, this is where we're headed.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're right, Buster. The only thing about the automated strike zone is, to me, they can't even get replay quite right. I mean, you see it more than I do when you're watching those replay cameras, and there's a close play. You can watch the replay, you know, 20, 25 times, and you can't tell whether it was the right call or not. You know, where you're watching a college basketball game or tennis or, you know, NFL, it seems like you know within 30 seconds. So we can't tell even from the camera angles we have on this, you know, are we sure we're going to have the right camera angles in baseball? And, you know, and the umpires will tell you, you know, the boxes and stuff on, you know, TV aren't quite right. You know, are they going to be able to adjust the electronic strike zone for an errant judge as they would a Jose Altuve? I'm not sure we're ready. I could see it, you know, maybe in 5 years or closer to 10. I don't think we're quite ready to do this yet.
Can you imagine a Game 7 of the World Series ending on a ball that, according to, you know, the eye test, the ball's out of the zone, but the automated strike zone called it a strike? Now, there's certainly, I mean, there are sound arguments, I think, for it, but that type of situation, oh, my God. The criticism that would follow would be absolutely nuts. And last one before you go, give me a favorite moment from your Hall of Fame weekend.
Well, too. I mean, one will go back to our good friend Jason Stark, and you know, Jason mentioned you several times, Buster. You know, just a you know, what it meant in his career, how special it was to be a ball writer. You know, just a everybody loves the game, but even more so, you know, love the people in the game. And Brandy Holliday, I thought Brandy stole the show. I thought she was beautiful and eloquent in her remarks about Roy, you know, not being perfect. She elaborated afterwards in the press conference after the ceremony. But she was, she was terrific in this. I thought her remarks, you know, were the best of anybody.
Bob, thanks for doing this. And when you see Boach later today and you want to make him smile, just tell him that you hear that he's got a really good mid-range jump shot. I played in a recreation league with him, and that was his game. It wasn't like around the basket. He had a great mid-range jump shot. And if you say that to him, I guarantee you he'll smile.
I will. And I'll tell you what, Buster, he has so much more energy now than he had when I saw him a month or 6 weeks ago. It's unbelievable. He is absolutely loving this. I tell you what, I mean, the season ended today. He's your National League Manager of the Year. You know, what a way to go out.
Absolutely. And I texted him the other day and I said, hey, I'm watching the Hall of Fame ceremony. I hope you're working on your speech. So hey, that is certainly in front of him for sure. Bob, thanks for doing this. Thanks for getting up.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you, Buster.
We'll be back in a moment with Sarah Langs. But first, we're headed toward crunch time in baseball. And if you haven't made it to a game yet, you still have time. And there's no better place to get your tickets than on SeatGeek. Because SeatGeek pulls millions of tickets into one place so you can easily find the seat you want for a price you're willing to pay. And get this, SeatGeek asks baseball fans from all 30 teams all across the country which stadiums have the best experience, from the food to the traffic. They ranked it all. If you want to know where your team ranks, check them out at www.seatgeek.com/stadium-guides. So, Troy, since you're not a true fan and have never been to a Rangers game, the next best thing you can do is check out the ballpark at Arlington on www.SeatGeek.com/stadium-guides. But whether your team ranked high or low, make sure to get out to a game this season with SeatGeek. And to help you get even more savings on tickets, our listeners get $10 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code BUSTER today. That's promo code BUSTER, B-U-S-T-E-R, for $10 off on your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, life's an event. We have the tickets.
Numbers game.
Sarah Langs is a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, before we play the numbers game, I need you to weigh in on something that Bob Nightingale and I were just talking about, how if the Red Sox decided to become sellers, if the next 6 days are a disaster for them and their front office decides, you know what, we're going to sell off pieces and parts, I think an interesting name is J.D. Martinez, who can opt out of his deal after this year. His agent is Scott Boras, who, as you know, is aggressive in the marketplace, trying to get his players into free agency. I said I feel like that JD could at least replicate the 3 years and about $66 million he has owed left from the Red Sox. And I mentioned, you know, Andrew McCutchen, about the same age last winter, got 3 years and $50 million. And 2 years ago, Carlos Santana got 3 years and $60 million from the Phillies. And JD was so good last year. He's, you know, solid this year. And he also has a reputation as being someone who can affect teammates with his preparation, kind of a Pied Piper of hitting. So I feel like he could at least replicate it. Bob disagreed with me. What's your take?
Yeah, I think he certainly could. I think McCutchen is a really good comparison because I think the similarity with the two of them is that at least since they've gotten to this point in their careers, they've both been really consistent, you know? I mean, JD is not having the season he had last year, but he's still already got 20 home runs. He's probably going to hit close to 30. And, you know, he's hitting 287, which is a little down for him, but he's basically hit 300 every year of his career since 2016. And, you know, even 2015, he was really good. So, I mean, I think that he could replicate it. And I think that what he has, I don't know how many players like him are necessarily going to be out there and how many players like him are even going to be available on a trademark. And I think that what he does is very valuable. You know, we talked about, you know, value in terms of the MVP conversation last year, but I don't mean in that way. I just mean in terms of a guy on a team. So I think he certainly could replicate that.
Yeah, and he'd be an impact hitter. And if from the Red Sox perspective, again, this is all theoretical at this point. We have no indication he's actually out there in the marketplace. But if they decide to become sellers, you could get, you know, a good prospect in return for a buyer. And I mentioned that the Dodgers, you would assume that Robert Van Scoyak, his hitting guru, who's now the hitting coach for the Dodgers, would at least be someone who'd be in the ear of the Dodgers saying this is someone who can really help. And from Boston's perspective, you could trade him for a prospect and then you could pursue him as a free agent in the winter if you wanted to have him back. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see if the Red Sox, you know, roll off a bunch of wins here. That conversation's never going to take place. All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three.
Number three is 11. So Jordan Alvarez now has 11 career home runs in just 30 total games in his career. That's tied for the third most home runs by any player in his first 30 career games ever. The only players with more home runs in their first 30 career games were Rhys Hoskins with 14 and Kevin Moss with 12. And of his 11 home runs, 7 have had an exit velocity of at least 105 miles an hour. And 7 have gone at least 410 feet, including his Astros StatCast era record 474-foot home run on July 19th. He also is the most RBI by a player in his first 30 career games since RBI became an official stat in 1920 with 35 RBI.
Number 2.
Number 2 is 133 and a third. That's how many innings it took Gerrit Cole to reach 200 strikeouts this year. According to Elias, that's the second fewest innings ever to reach 200 strikeouts in a season. Randy Johnson reached 200 strikeouts in 130 and two-thirds innings in 2001. Johnson finished that year with 372 strikeouts, which is the third most in a season in the modern era. The Astros franchise record is 313 by J.R. Richard in 1979, and there have been two other 300-strikeout seasons in franchise history. Mike Scott in 1986 with 306, and Richard with 303 in 1978.
Number one.
Number one is 16-3. The Giants are 16-3 in their last 19 games, which is their best 19-game stretch since 2016, which is, of course, the last time that they made the postseason. Through June 29th, they were 35-47, a season high 12 games below 500, 8.5 games behind in the wild card, sitting in last place in the NL West. They're now 2 games behind in the wild card, tied for second in the division, and 1 game above 500, the first time they've been above 500 all season. They're 15-3 in July. They had 15 losses in April and 16 losses in May. It's quite a turnaround. We talked about how the kind of spot it's putting them in, but it's certainly something to see.
Yeah, it'll be absolutely fascinating to see what happens with them over the next week. We've got about 8 days and 7 hours until the trade deadline. Before we go, Sarah, give me one team that you think, one contender that you think, man, they have to make a trade. They have to get better.
Well, I mean, if the Nationals are considering themselves a contender here, and I think they are with the run that they've gone on over the last month and a half or so, they absolutely have to upgrade that bullpen. I feel like we've had this conversation so many times in July with them. Unfortunately, this has been what has plagued them, but they just absolutely have to do something with that.
Yeah, and if they do that, Sarah, I really, when you look at the landscape of the National League, I think they would be the biggest potential threat to the Dodgers. If they got a really good back end of the bullpen in a short series against L.A., that would be a dangerous team.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? I picked them entering the year, and I felt so silly about it on April 15th. I think I picked them to lose the World Series, but I picked them to get there, and I would love to not feel as silly about that.
There you go. All right, Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
David Meller is the Senior Director of Grounds at Fenway Park, and he's the author of the new book, One Base at a Time, How I Survived PTSD and Found My Field of Dreams. Dave, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. Thank you for the opportunity to be on your podcast.
Well, I wrote the foreword to this book, I wrote in the foreword about my first conversation with you, which was remarkable to me. I'll never forget it. It was about 5 minutes before a game, and I was nervous about, you know, what I was going to say on air. And so I saw you walking by, and I think you were carrying a rake at the time. And I just asked you, hey, how did you get into this? And you gave me a look, and you said, well, it's an amazing story. And sure enough, it's an incredible story, how you wind up where you are, the journey that you've taken. And you detail that in your book about the impact of your experience and injuries. And it sounds like, you know, from my conversation with you, you really related to a lot of people who have dealt with PTSD.
You know, yes, sir, I think I'm one of the luckiest people in the world. You know, I've been hit by a car 3 times. I figure that's better than 4. And I've had 45 surgeries and figure that's better than 46. I have an incredible family. And, you know, if I would have given up along the way, I never would have met my incredible wife, have 2 amazing daughters, have a career that I enjoy so much. I wouldn't be the person I am if I didn't have the opportunity to learn from and have these different challenges shape me into who I am. And I had 1 to 5 horrific nightmares every night for 29 years. And I didn't know what was causing those. And luckily, in 2010, I read a Smithsonian magazine that listed 12 symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And as I was reading those, I realized I either actively had or had dealt with 10 of those 12 symptoms. And while it scared the heck out of me, it gave me hope, Buster, hope that if I did have PTSD and got treatment, that I could be a better dad and a better husband. And I had rehearsed for years since 1982. I read this article in 2010. I had rehearsed how to explain to my wife all these symptoms that were going on inside me. You know, she had dealt with screaming nightmares and hearing me wake up, and I would try to blame it on the TV or just say not to worry about it. And she dealt with my mood swings. And when I read this article, it was an aha moment. So I went home and told her everything that was going on and explained the symptoms. And up to that point, I only thought you could get PTSD from the horrors of war. But now I know anyone can get post-traumatic stress from a life-threatening trauma. And I used to think it was a sign of weakness to ask for help, but now I know it's a sign of strength. And through the book, we want to bring awareness to not only PTSD, but also service dogs. I have an amazing service dog, Drago, and we just want to inspire people to not give up, because we all face challenges of our own.
Challenges you faced, as you related in that first conversation we had about, and you made mention of the being run over by automobiles, it was incredible. And at one point, as you're, you know, at the end of high school, going into college, your thought was you were going to pitch, you played baseball yourself. and then you had this series of events happen. Can you just sort of explain those?
Yes, sir. My dream was to make it to the majors as a player. My grandfather played 1902 in the majors, and I grew up a Red Sox fanatic. So I wanted to make it to the majors and someday play at Fenway. And I played ball in high school, had opportunities to play scholarships. And a month after I got out of high school, I was walking into a McDonald's, and a car hit me, threw me 20 feet in the air, and the car kept coming at a higher rate of speed and hit me a second time, pinning my leg against the wall. So I walked on crutches for 2.5 years and walked with a cane for 10 months and had to learn how to walk again. And my family encouraged me to find a career that I'd love to do. And I thought, what do I really love? I love being outside. Science was the subject I enjoyed in school, and I loved baseball. So I put all those together and figured someone had to be a groundskeeper. And my brother lived in Milwaukee at the time and told me if I could get a job with the Brewers, I could live with him to save money. So I went to Ohio State to get a degree, and 35 years ago, the Brewers gave me an opportunity, and I've been blessed ever since with a job in the majors. Been at Fenway for about 19 years.
And later, when you were with the Brewers, incredibly, again, hit by an automobile.
Yes, sir. In 1995, we were resodding the outfield, or resodding the whole field, and I was raking around an irrigation head out in left field, and we had big double gates to an entrance to the field behind the left fielder, and I heard a car and car noises I was very hypersensitive to, and I heard a car, and I thought, that's weird, and I turned around, and there was a car coming from behind the bleachers toward the field. So I ran over to the warning track and put my arms up for the driver to stop, and she smiled as big as she could and stepped on the gas and came right at me and hit me. And I landed in a pile at the base of the wall pads, and she went speeding around, made a full lap around the track, and aimed right at me to hit me again. And at the last minute, she swerved to miss me and then slammed on the brakes, sat up in the car, and waved excessively at me, and then stepped on the gas and peeled out and covered me in track material and went out behind the bleachers and started cussing at the guard to let her out. And turned out she had a past history with mental illness. 1991, she had assaulted Julio Iglesias in Florida for stalking Julio, for stalking him. 1993, she was arrested on international charges threatening the Queen of England. And the night before she did this in Chicago, she tried to assault Oprah, but had gotten away.
That's unbelievable. And as you and I in the past have talked about, that as you have talked to more and more veterans about your experience and about PTSD, you found that they can really find solace, and especially because you're being someone that they can relate to because you work at Fenway Park, which was a dream for you when you got that job.
Yes, sir. You know, we want to bring awareness to PTSD to help veterans and people in all walks of life, to let them know that they're not alone, that help's available, and that treatment works. And we want people to learn to celebrate life every day, because you never know when the next challenge in your life will happen. You know, my brother died suddenly in 1998. And there's so many things I wish I would have told him, and I missed my opportunity. And just 2 years ago, flying on a domestic airline, I was severely injured when the luggage compartment door came disconnected and slammed into my head and shoulder, and I'm still dealing with post-concussion syndrome from a severe concussion, and it dislocated my clavicle, which I've had 2 surgeries on, and you just never know when that next challenge will happen. So I just encourage people to tell the people around them how much they love them and not miss that opportunity and celebrate life every day, because you just never know.
And you do in your work as director of grounds at Fenway Park. Dave, you're famous for a lot of the patterns that you guys will cut into the grass on the field, and you were absolutely at the forefront of that trend.
Well, yeah, thank you, Buster. You know, it's a lot of teamwork. The first mower was made in 1830, so patterns have been around, but our first goal is safety and playability for the field, but I think you have one opportunity to make a first impression, whether it's a traditional checkerboard pattern or something festive like the Sox logo. You know, I think growing up a Buckeye, I'm a Buckeye grad and a Red Sox fanatic. I think there's any patterns possible, but there's two patterns that might kill the grass. That would be a Michigan logo or a Yankee logo. But otherwise, it's all about having fun and keeping the field safe. But you can do them on your home lawn, too.
I'm sure you get asked a lot.
Well, I get asked how to do those a lot. And so my first book called Picture Perfect, and my second book was The Lawn Bible. So there's turf tips in there as well as how to create your own patterns.
And I'm sure you get asked a lot about your support dog, Draga, who's on the cover of your book. And I see when I'm at the ballpark and see you walking around with Drago, a lot of players come up to you and ask about him.
Yes, sir. Drago is incredible. He is, other than my wife, he's my best friend. He's trained and tasked to help me with mobility as well as post-traumatic stress to should he sense anxiety. He's trained to get me to distract me, to get me to focus on him. He's also trained not to go to the bathroom on grass, so he's on the field with me all the time. And other than rain games, when I work out of the dugout, he'll usually stay in the office. And he is good friends with a lot of the players. And, we want to bring awareness to service dogs and how they can truly change people's lives. I never realized how much a service dog does. You know, they're not a therapy dog. They're not a support dog. You know, they're a medical tool, and they're trained to assist a person and really do much more than I ever realized they could do, and he's just an important part of my life.
Well, Dave, great job with the book, and I appreciate your time. Thanks for talking with me today, and I will see you over the weekend, next weekend at Fenway.
I look forward to it, and thank you so much, Buster, for all your support.
Bleacher Tweets.
Okay, Buster, we got some quick Bleacher Tweets for you here. The first one comes from Zachary Massengale at Zachman4Mass. Just ask simply, does Albert Pujols have a shot at unanimous selection to the Hall of Fame?
Not only does he have a shot, it would be an embarrassment if he wasn't voted in unanimously, given how incredible his career numbers are going to be when he's done. And by the way, it looks like he does have a shot to reach 700 homers. He's got, 648, 52 more to go. He's got 2 years left on his contract. Absolutely, he should be unanimous selection.
Yeah, I definitely agree. He's had such an amazing career. Mitchell at Tigers_of Detroit. In MVP discussions, the first stat I hear quoted is WAR, wins above replacement. I don't often hear the same argument for Cy Young and pitching WAR. Is the stat just less refined? Mike Minor, of my Rangers, leads by over a win in both metrics, yet he doesn't seem to be the big favorite, as the stat suggests.
And it's a fair point, and you remember this, Troy, that at the All-Star break, number one in pitching WAR, according to Fangraphs, was Max Scherzer. Number two, you're Lance Lynn of the Rangers. I think that the fact that different sites have different formulas and it's not as close to, I think, where the position players are, it's a work in progress, I think. And I think part of the question I think I've always had about it is how much strikeouts are valued. You know, how much should strikeouts be valued in an era when there's so many?
Really good question, Mitchell. Next one comes from Jeremy Gonzalez at J_Gonzo55. As an Astros fan and seeing Mariano Rivera get into the Hall of Fame, I can't help but think about Billy Wagner's career. His numbers are on par with other relievers recently inducted, but he's not getting the love from voters. What gives? Will he ever get in?
Yes, he will get in. I don't know if he's going to be voted in by the writers or if it's going to be through a veterans committee, but eventually he'll get in. I think the fact that in recent years you've seen the Hall of Fame voters really soften with their approach to relievers, with designated hitters, with more specialist-type players, will help future candidates. And, you know, lastly, Trevor Hoffman and Mariano Rivera, and I think Billy Wagner at some point gets in.
Another question comes from Quest at Quest Called Tribe. Hey, Buster, Trevor Bauer's tutelage and knowledge of analytics has helped younger Tribe pitchers like Shane Bieber, Mike Clevenger, and Zach Plesac in their developments. Does that play into his trade value, or is it only what he actually does on the mound?
I think it's part of the evaluation. Look, I've heard from executives with teams that are looking at Trevor, and they're saying they're well aware of the fact that he's open-minded, he looks at analytics. He wants to apply those numbers, and that's what front offices want these days. And on the other hand, they also hear he's very active in social media. He's had a couple things pop up with that that haven't been necessarily things that teams want. And early in the career, he had a reputation as being a difficult teammate. So I think all of those are weighed in as clubs make decisions on Trevor.
Last Bleach tweet comes from Jason Amico, at Jason Amico, who just wants to know, Buster, what was your first obscure baseball job?
How about this one, Troy? When I was in Nashville and I was making my way through college, I made $10 per game being the official scorer for a Babe Ruth League over at Shelby Park in Nashville. $10 a game being the official scorer at night.
Wow, how about that? You've come a long way.
It was kind of a cool job, though. You know, it'd be a nice evening, and you'd sit down, and, you know, you give a guy an error, you give a guy a hit, and you turn in your official score, and you get some cash.
Oh, I'm sure. Great tweets today. Really creative questions. I'm really impressed. Keep them coming using the hashtag BleacherTweets. We have the best listeners every day, Buster. I mean, the tweets that come across, I'm really impressed by the creativity and the thoughtfulness.
Yep.
So thank you for that. Thank you for listening, and if our fans want to get even smarter than they already are, you can check out the Fantasy Focus Baseball podcast and give that a listen wherever you find your podcast.
And that's it for today, a Baggage Claim Tuesday. My thanks to Dave Meller, to Sarah Langs, to Bob Nightingale. Man, getting up at 5:15 in the morning, San Francisco time, to join us, and Troy Farkas, who produces back in Bristol. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.